1975. The cornfields of Iowa. A wholesome and uncorrupted young man had a dream to be on the radio.
Roy, you should change your name to Bat Segundo.
I think it's pronounced Segundo, Pop.
Segundo, Segundo, however the heck them folks down south pronounce it. You got a voice, son. A bona fide, God-given, genuine gift. If I didn't know any better, I'd call you Wonder Boy.
And so, the young and newly christened Bat Segundo, or Segundo, depending upon your regional location and educational level, spent long and hard afternoons practicing in front of the mic, honing his voice for a burgeoning and far from lucrative career, working the overnight shift for an FM radio station with a not-so-stellar Arbitron rating. Growing tired of the cranks and insomniacs who pestered him each night to constantly put on Stairway to Heaven and Freebird, Mr. Segundo started wondering if being natural at this business was all it was cracked up to be.
Pop, they keep pestering me for Skinnerd. I really want them to stop calling so I can give them an entertaining program.
Let me give you a little bit of advice, son. There ain't much work out there that ain't pockmarked with a little unpleasant grit.
And so, with a determined work ethic, and the foreclosure of the family farm hanging in the balance, Mr. Segundo grew miserable and despondent and wasn't sleeping very well. Until, one day, he heard a call from God.
Segundo, you don't have to pay.
God, is that, you?
Yes, it is he. I offer you salvation. Please take this bottle of tequila. Use it wisely but judiciously. Plaster yourself silly. Really, it is a graveyard shift. No one is truly going to care.
And so, Mr. Segundo proved that he had two gifts in the world. Alcohol became a natural component of his radio show appearances, and he began breaking FCC rules. He was swearing at the people who called in. What proved to be a promising career was effectively flushed down the toilet, thanks in part to the copious amounts of tequila that Mr. Segundo imbibed.
I am here with Chris Elliott, author of The Shroud of the Thwacker. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. It's a great honor. Now, I should point out and apologize to you in advance, as well as my listeners, but I've had 90 minutes of sleep last night. So if any of my questions deteriorate and I become debilitated during the course of this conversation, I apologize to you, Chris, and also to anyone who might be listening
to
this.
Well, it's going to be pretty interesting because that's about all I had last night.
Really?
Yeah.
So we have a common bond here.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's funny. So we're both punchy.
Oh, okay, well, that's great. That's great. Well, now I read that you were actually lured into the publishing industry for money. Is this true?
that I went into this for money?
Yeah, which was curious for me because I mean you realize most writers actually don't make a lot of money making these books. They have to sell their supplemental
income. You know, that's sort of in the book. My persona is writing the book for money, but
it's interesting because a couple of articles I read actually put this in their articles and believe the persona actually carried over to Chris Elliott.
That is the thing that I am always constantly amazed at, and that people actually. There are still people that see my product as on face value, whatever it is I'm doing, whether it's a movie or a TV show. And to me, it's always been like, yeah, I've produced something, but it's always the joke really is that it's me doing it. It's not so much the thing. And that's the same with the book. It is a parody of, you know, historical crime thrillers, but it's also a parody of my first novel, what I would have done in my first novel, you know, and that stuff goes back to Letterman. So,
well, what provoked the move to fiction exactly?
Well, you mean the, you know, I've been doing nonfiction my whole life.
Yes. Yeah.
I think I had the idea actually. I did have the idea before I decided to write a book. Nobody said you should go try to come up with a book idea. I was sitting around, and actually the first thing that came to mind was doing a historical book on New York City's and kind of without doing much research on it, making it all up. And then I thought, you know, I'd like to add a story to it. And I had been reading those. thrillers like The Alienist and books like that, and I was a fan of those, and so I decided to combine the two ideas.
Well, I was going to point that out, the Patricia Cornwell and the Caleb Carr, but I was wondering if there are any other authors that might have specifically influenced you for this.
Every year there's a new book on Jack the Ripper that comes out, and I think that was sort of another idea in the back of my head all along, was to maybe write a parody of a Ripper book with my own version of who I think the Ripper was. So I've woven that into this book. And so any Ripper book, I would say I'm a fan of. In this, there's also Jack Finney. There's a little bit of Time and Again. You know, there's some time travel thrown into this. And then I did like the Da Vinci Code. You know, I read that, and there's some of that in this also.
Huh. Did you ever read the graphic novel From Hell?
No,
You may want to check that out. Yeah.
I didn't. Okay. What's neat now is that everybody who's read this book is like telling me other books that would help me make this one better if I had read them. But so I'm making a list.
Well, what kind of, I guess I wanted to sort of get a sense of you perhaps before we start talking about your book as a reader and how sort of you kind of gravitated towards fiction. Would you say that you're a fairly heavy reader? Or?
Well,
I mean, we've already established the research question here.
Right. No, I'm only, the problem with me is because I'm also acting that a lot of my time is spent reading scripts that are sent my way, because I'm sent a lot of scripts. Yeah. You can imagine that if you've seen my career. And if it's not a script, then usually if I'm reading something, I try to make use of the time and think, well, maybe, you know, if I like it, maybe I can parlay this into something else. Maybe I can parody it or something like that. And so my reading is generally connected to some project I'm going to do. I'm writing another book for Miramax now about Mount Everest. So I'm reading a lot of sort of adventure climbing books and that sort of thing.
Gotcha. Sir Chris Hillary.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it's about a bunch of celebrities who climb Mount Everest for charity.
Well, I was curious. This book has received a very curious reception.
Yes.
I read, for example, I was like kind of looking through the book reviews, and one of the ones that caught my eye was from the Columbus Dispatch, which had this headline: "Actor's silly thriller parody makes delightfully idiotic debut."
Oh, I didn't hear that one. That's nice.
And what was even stranger was that like he called Shroud one of the most idiotic books to be published in some time, and yet he praised it simultaneously. Do you find this to be a problem, the fact that people say, oh, well, this is sort of sophomoric humor, but at the same time, I enjoy it? Is this sort of an issue for you?
No, that's perfect for me. That review is actually perfect because it sort of does exactly what I was saying in the beginning. It supplies a humorous novel, but it's also he also gets that it's silly and that it's nonsensical and that it sounds like he gets that it's a parody of a novel also. That to me is high praise. And I even Get a Life, anything I've ever done, it's always there are some people that just look at it and just think it's completely stupid. And then there's other people that think it's stupid but also understand why I'm being so stupid. And, Get a Life, for whatever it's worth, was itself kind of a parody of a sitcom. I've always liked working those levels, not to keep going back to Letterman, but back, that is, the beginnings of my career and writing. And back then I was this staff member coming out who desperately wanted to be on television. And there was a lot of truth to that. Even though I was, acting when I went out, I still wasn't an actor hired to be a staff member trying to be a big movie star or TV star. That was me. So, those levels I've always enjoyed working at. It sounds like I've succeeded, at least for that person.
But at the same time, though, you have kind of been confined. I mean, we'll get to the book. I'm predominantly a literary podcast, but I do want to talk about this other stuff.
Right.
For the last sort of 20 years, you have sort of been confined to the sort of Chris Elliott persona.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if maybe that gets sort of tiresome after doing this for like 20 years.
To me?
Yeah.
I can't do anything else. I mean, so I don't know from whether it gets me, it's tiresome or not. I've tripped over it occasionally. Like when I was at Saturday Night Live, I realized, I couldn't do my persona there. I couldn't be sort of an Lorne Michaels used to call me an anti-performer because, and he's right. Like I said, it was always Chris Elliott, you know, performing whenever I came out and on Letterman, and at Saturday Night Live, you really can't do that. You have to be a straight out performer. You have to come out and do a dead on impersonation, and that you can't make fun of yourself as much as I used to be able
but
to do.
But you did play a serial killer on Third Watch.
Yeah. Occasionally I have, you know, made these attempts at seeing if there's anything else out there that I could do. But that, honestly, I could not watch that myself, my own performance on that. You know, I didn't believe it. You know, other people did. Other people yeah. said they believed it and caught it and that's a very rare thing for me to do.
But surely repeated efforts and attempting this sort of ambitious thespic sort of outside of the Chris Elliott persona kind of thing. Certainly after a couple of attempts of this, you would probably maybe develop onto your own accord. I'm certain, you know. Do you think so?
I don't think so. I think that you know, and you have to understand some things I do for money.
Yeah.
You know, some things yeah. I do because I'm offered it and I'm not working and I go, yeah, sure, okay, I'll try that. Mm-hmm. But there's certain actors you can look at. I believe Bill Murray when he acts. I believe Billy Crystal when he's serious. I believe Steve Martin I'm not sure I would believe Carrot Top being, you know, trying to do a serious role, you know, and that's the same with me.
Comparing yourself to Carrot Top then.
I'm saying that what we do, not that what I do is like Carrot Top's, yeah. I'm saying what he does and what I do is, you know, in its own category, and we, you know, to cross over and try to be a serious actor is a lot to ask of an audience.
Yeah.
You know, to believe you in that.
Okay. Well, back to the book, and this kind of ties into where I'm going with this whole persona question. The persona that we're talking about here actually carries into Shroud, and I'm wondering, this is fiction. Your audience are basically readers. There is no one sort of like, you know, watching you. So as a result, you can sort of get away with certain elements of, you know, certain stretching of the truth if you believe that you can't do anything more than the Chris Elliott persona.
Right.
Why sort of stick to the Chris Elliott persona when writing the novel?
Well, you know, in case they make it into a movie.
Okay.
I want to be in it.
Okay.
I think I've taken the persona a little further than I've had the chance to anywhere else in this book. You
yeah.
know, he's still an idiot in the book, which is my persona, but
I had no idea that the persona was a cross-dresser.
Right, yeah. He cross-dresses just for comfort's sake.
Sure.
Yeah, and
well, you're in the right town for that.
Exactly, just to relax, you know, with a cup of chamomile tea. He likes to put on a skirt, but I don't know. That also, you know, this book essentially I wrote for my fans, which I'm finding out, believe it or not, I have some
yeah.
of, and you know, I'm blown away by that. But this, you know, the idea of putting myself in the book was, you know, it's again in line with the Chris Elliott, you know, persona of always trying to get my face into out there, you know, and always trying to, you know, there's a slight, you know, Lucy-esque quality to my nut character, you know. He's just always trying to, you know, get in front of an audience.
What I found interesting about this book was that the Chris Elliott persona, he starts out as a narrator, and
right.
then he gradually becomes a pivotal portion of the plot.
That's right.
Was midway while we were writing this, you were thinking, oh, well, if the film rights get sold.
That's what I was thinking. I'd like
really?
To be in it. No, I think I knew that, you know, when I started writing this book, I really didn't know exactly what the plot was going to be.
No outline or anything?
No, I didn't do an outline. I knew what the ending was going to be, and I knew that and I'm not giving anything away, I wanted, there's time travel. It's about, you know, the investigation into these crimes back in 1882, and I tell that story, but I'm also telling the story of my reinvestigation into those crimes. Mm-hmm. And at some point, both those lines of inquiry cross one another, and I discover a time machine, and I'm hurled back into 1882. And I know when I pitched the story, I told them that much. I told them that, you know, I might get accused of the crimes myself. But I wasn't really sure, you know, how I was going to tie everything together. You know, what I pitched to them, you know, was basically I had written most of chapter one, and I knew what the ending was going to be, and they knew right away what I was parroting, and the voice of the book. They understood it right away, to their credit, Miramax's. And I told them it's going to get crazy, it's going to go all over the place, and then hopefully at the end I'll be able to tie, you know, most everything together.
So it sounds like you had a pretty free deal there to sort of figure out the story.
I did. They knew I was. I told them, I think that, you know, I'm going to want to do a sequence at Dreamland out in Coney Island, and you know, down in Bandit's Roost, and down at the you know, maybe something in the Five Points, and do something with the gangs, like the gangs in New York kind of thing. And they knew the whole world that I was, you know, playing around with, so they didn't really push me to, you know, give them specifics in terms of the story yet.
Well, the thing that actually interested me about this book was that it actually shares a very interesting quality with Cabin Boy, which actually, guilty pleasure, I happen to like Cabin Boy.
Don't be embarrassed.
No, I'm not embarrassed. I'm not. I don't understand why it's like there's a Cabin Boy Anonymous somewhere.
We did. There was a screening of it in Boston, and it was a combination signing and a screening, and there were over 400 people there. Mm-hmm. And they were laughing at the movie, but not laughing because it's so bad it's good. Yeah. You know, they were actually, you know, they were laughing at the right places, which, you know, I was amazed at and very happy with.
Well, I guess the parallel I wanted to draw between this book and Cabin Boy was that both of these stories take place in sort of a time that sort of borrows elements from like every conceivable epic in history.
Right.
And I found that to be, I'm wondering why that is with you. I mean, do you feel sort of, I guess, hindered by one particular place, or what's the deal with, like, if I'm in 1882, there are things from the 21st century, there are things from the 15th century.
Well, in this book, there's specific reasons for it. In this book, the idea is that I didn't know what the hell I was doing when I was writing it. So I was making up the fact that, you know, oh, they had cell phones back there, and Chris Elliott narrator or persona that was writing the book would have imagined, oh, if they had cell phones, they must have been big wooden ones that, you know, had to be, you know, gas powered if they had, and they must have had them.
I thought very much of the Flintstones or something.
Right. There was a little bit of that in there for sure. But in Cabin Boy, honestly, it was more, that was, if we had had our choice, we wouldn't have done it that way. It was sort of, that script was written for Tim Burton to direct.
Yeah.
And Tim Burton had sort of crossed over those lines quite a bit in his work in terms of not real, you know, Batman, you weren't really sure, you know, there were old 1940s cars and stuff, you know, but at the same time, you know, there were, you know, guns that were from, you know, the future and all this, you know, you weren't really sure what time period that was either.
So you're saying that there was like a rewrite on Cabin Boy once, like, Tim Burton may have kind of gotten involved to actually direct, maybe?
There was
this sort of timelessness kind of,
it hadn't been written yet when he got involved, but in terms of writing it, we were definitely keeping that in mind. You know, we were keeping in, you know, just blending those time period type things, you know, like you know, having me in a turn of the century, you know, costume, but getting into a regular limo. You know, there was definitely, you know, talked about,
but it carries over into the book, though. Yeah,
but there was no real reason for it in that movie. Yeah. You know, that movie, I think it would have been served better had that not been in it. And the original idea for that movie, you know, was to do kind of a parody of Captain's Courageous, and at that point it would have just been set in the 30s, like the movie was, with Freddie Bartholomew. There was no real reason to do that sort of weird sort of crossover of elements from different eras. In this book, though, there is, to me, and I think I'm pretty true to, you know, the parts that are in present day, they're in present day. There isn't anything really weird going on there, you know, other than a time machine.
Now, the Dakota thing actually interested me because we just recently, last week, it was the 25th anniversary. We celebrate these things, apparently. The 25th anniversary of John Lennon's murder. And I'm thinking to myself, was this book actually timed to sort of coincide with that, you know?
No, this was one of those things I just saw. You know, I had absolutely no idea, you know, that this was the 25th anniversary.
Really?
You know?
Well, yeah. What drew you to the Dakota?
The vehicle for going back into time in Jack Finney's book.
Oh, okay.
Time and Again, and it's also just the sort of icon in New York of mystery, movies and novels. You know, it's a mysterious looking dark building and all that, and Yoko plays a part in the book, and she of course lives there. So,
well, the strange thing also about the incongruous sort of celebrities, where you have first of all, Teddy Roosevelt was not mayor of New York.
He ran
for mayor, and actually 4 years after the book, 1886, I believe, and he actually came in third.
Right,
he was police commissioner.
Right,
he was 24 actually during the course.
People have actually come up and gone, You do know Teddy Roosevelt was police commissioner, right, of New York? And you go, yes, I know.
Yeah. But, I mean, why sort of these kinds of – I'm going to go ahead and place like Yoko Ono or Don Imus or whoever in this book, but I'm going to completely sort of just do away with any kind of logic. I'm just wondering what sort of motivates this factor.
I think that the – part of it was not planning the book out much, when you write a script, you card it out, and then you're just connecting the dots, and it's, can be sort of really dull, and you have to get to that next card to get you to the next card.
Yeah.
And with this, I didn't really do that. And so I would come down and sit at my typewriter, and I would know, okay, this chapter I'm going to go back in time, or this chapter I'm going to go, the main characters are going to go out to Coney Island or whatever. But
you type this on a typewriter?
No, I still say typewriter.
Okay. Well, I was about to say, I didn't know you were a closet sort of typewriter junkie.
Is that what I said?
Yes.
Did I say typewriter?
Yes, you did.
That's
you
so
did.
Funny. Yeah. No. Wheel writer. No, I'm up to a wheel writer now. But I think that, while I was doing it, I just suddenly, these people started coming in, and I started thinking about them. I thought, when I go back in time, it's funny if I buy something from, a young Larry King, something like that. I don't know exactly where they came from. I know that, the thing with Yoko, she was going to be part of the plot.
Yeah.
So that I knew also when I pitched the story.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else, Liz Smith, who's one of the characters in the book, is, I've always been fascinated with what people were like when they were younger. And when I was a kid, there was this movie, Young Winston, about Winston Churchill. And I've always been, just strangely fascinated to that. It's how people develop and what they were like when they were, in their 20s and compared to what they're like now, if they're elderly. And not that Liz Smith is elderly, but I wanted, a woman who was, known today, and also, again, not to give anything away, but the time travel element there was integral in choosing her. And somebody who was strong and, that people could relate to right away. And I thought it would be funny for people who know Liz Smith nowadays to be imagining her, back in the turn of the century.
Now, was this the first sort of major project that you have sort of written alone? Because you've worked with Adam Resnick in the past. You've worked with a number of writers on Letterman.
Yeah.
And this one, I guess you went about it solo. Was this kind of a stumbling block for you? I mean, was this like the first book you wrote with your father. So.
Right. Although we actually wrote that book the way it was conceived, which was, the idea of that book was that it was a parody of Mommy Dearest, and it was called Daddy's Boy. But the idea was that I had absolutely nothing to complain about as a kid, so I had to make everything up. And so for legal reasons, he got to rebut every other chapter. And and in the foreword, I said, well, the way this is going to work is I'm going to write a chapter and I'll send it to my dad up in Maine and he'll read it and write his chapter and send it back. And literally, that's how we wrote the book. We did not. I didn't call him. I didn't tell him what my chapters were going to be mm-hmm. at all. He would just get them and read them and then write whatever non sequitur response he wanted to write. So essentially I wrote that by myself too. But that wasn't – it didn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end mm-hmm. to it. It was just a series of –
You had something to respond to basically.
Yeah, and it was more or less just a series of unrelated fake incidences from my childhood. This actually has a story. And I wrote it by myself, but at the same time my wife was reading my first drafts of everything that I wrote so I could hear whether things were funny when she was, correcting the spelling and stuff like that. I had friends who have written novels that were looking at it and saying, that's good, that's great. I asked advice from everybody, that I know that's done something like this. So I didn't feel totally alone. I was alone at my typewriter while I was working.
Again, but, the invention of things from many times here. Well, I got the sense too as I was reading this that you were sort of discovering 10-cent words or SAT words during the course of writing.
Well,
this.
That's cool that you say that, because that's one of those things that I wanted it to seem like, I was writing it with a thesaurus right by my side, which I did with Daddy's Boy also. There was definitely that element in it too,
There were also very specific, I would read a paragraph and it would go from past to present tense to past tense.
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if was that
it's
deliberate?
Not well written.
Yeah. I mean, did you sort of go out of your way to deliberately sort of mangle sentences?
Well, to a degree, yeah. And also to overwrite. Okay. Certainly the opening, overly descriptive opening of the first chapter, yeah. Was sort of, I could never have written the whole book like that, but I wanted to write that first, to give people right away to show in their face that, okay, this is making fun of what – I'm making fun of what I'm doing here, just so you know that,
yeah.
Before you get any further. And some of it was deliberate, and some of it is just that it's my first book, mm-hmm. So there wasn't a very heavy editing process on this book.
Really?
Which I've heard is fairly common, I guess. It's not. There isn't a lot of editing
If you read books, as many books as I do, I've noticed typos all the time. They make their way into the paperback edition. It's
right,
crazy.
Right.
We're like the fourth or fifth printing. It's
right. I haven't seen too many typos, but I just mean, I
also line edits,
and that sort of thing. There were some, but not half as many as I thought there should or expected there to be, because I.
No Maxwell Perkins figure here.
No, and when you on a script, that goes through such a mill, mm-hmm. of being rewritten, not just by you, but by lots of writers,
yeah.
And I specifically overwrote this book thinking, okay, well, people will, weed through the bad jokes and keep the good ones. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a lot of that. This is essentially the first draft
yeah.
that was published. And wow. There's one part in here, how, and I'm being very honest, but there's this one part where, when Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday, before he came up with Yesterday, the story goes that he had, he used scrambled eggs while he was
yes.
working on the thing. He called yes. it scrambled eggs. And there is a joke in here that ends with scrambled eggs, because I didn't have the joke yet, but I wanted to finish the chapter.
And it's actually
and it's in the book.
Wow.
So somebody read it and laughed at it and left it in.
I'll have to use the Amazon Inside the Book feature.
Yeah.
Just okay. Scrambled eggs into there.
Yeah.
We'll find that out.
I think it's the.
It's kind of funny. It's
I either use scrambled or I use fried eggs. I can't remember, but it's something about that Caleb had, a look of incredulity and combination of that and scrambled eggs. I didn't have the other joke yet,
Really? Now, during the course of since you didn't actually have an outline or a sort of story, was that this a problem for you in sort of trying to kind of come up with ideas to propel the plot? Or?
Absolutely not. The opposite. I wasn't hemmed in by anything. I could go anywhere I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to do Bandit's Ruse, because that's a common thing when you think about that, or the – the Bend, the Mulberry Bend area of New York City, and I knew places that I wanted to go, but it was a freeing experience. It sounds really pompous, but it was a very freeing experience for me.
I've heard about the, you've probably been asked this numerous times, but the boilerplate Paul Guinan situation. I read somewhere that there was basically, it's interesting that Guinan's book actually came out at roughly the same time as yours. And there's been some sort of internet discussion about, hey, you know, Elliot and Guinan, there was no lawsuit. So maybe two guys are sort of together, like working on some sort of like mutual publicity. Well, would you care to respond to this rumor or dispel them?
Well, I'm happy that rumor is out there. That just adds to it. I think that actually the fact that that's in the book to me is hilarious.
Yeah.
And the fact that the way that it got in is hilarious. And,
well, it was your brother that discovered this, not you necessarily.
Yes. But boilerplate was not, I mean, it was more the boilerplate I never thought was something that could have existed. I thought, but the bio on its inventor was convincing to me. So I put that in the book.
Even though he went ahead and fought with Theodore Roosevelt and designed.
I didn't get that far. Yeah. But I was throwing in like things from the turn of the century that were real in addition to the stuff that I was making up. So when I saw that, I was like, okay, well, we'll throw that in there. And then it turns out that it's something Paul Guinan had created. And Paul and I talked afterwards because no one caught it. And we were basically both...
if you publish a book with Miramax books, hire an editor to look at it beforehand.
Well, I don't think even anyone, I'm not sure anyone else would have either.
There's no legal team,
it's hard to sort of, you know, to differentiate between something like that and, you know, a gas-powered cell phone, we licensed it and so everything worked out fine. But it, to me, I think it's funny that, you know, even the slightest bit of research that it was actually done on the book ended up being flawed as well.
Yeah. Well, also the illustration was, illustration's actually, this is a clear case of nepotism.
Yes.
Your sister did them.
My sister did them. And I did, I wanted the illustrations to have this, I wanted them to be feminine because
there's the one of you in the
that one certainly is feminine, but I wanted them to be like a children's book illustrator because I thought that in opposition to what I was writing would be a really cool sort of thing, and I think they came out great. Actually, I love her illustrations.
Yeah.
I mean, the original idea was to really do like sort of Harper's, you know, kind of, and Collier's sort of pen and ink etching type illustrations from that period. But I like the way she interpreted them better.
I know you have to go soon, but there is one thing I wanted to ask
you.
And that was, we were talking earlier about sort of infantile humor. Is there a part of Chris Elliott that is more of an Evelyn Waugh or P.G. Wodehouse, or someone who is far wittier? I mean, if this book, for example, sells, and you prove that, yes, Chris Elliott does have an audience of people who will buy his books, you've got a second book lined up here. So what will happen with the second book? Will we see the same Chris Elliott persona? Will we see something in which Chris Elliott, the real Chris Elliott, the Chris Elliott sitting here before me, actually sort of, you know, proves that he's a lot wittier than people make him out to be?
I feel like I've proved that already with the Shroud of the Thwacker. No, I don't know. Of course not. I mean, why would I ever do that? I mean, that's like me trying to be a serious actor, you know, I would never do that. And yes, the persona that's the Chris Elliott persona that's in this book is also in my next book, Climbing Mount Everest.
But surely that's got to be tedious, though,
for maybe the readers.
No, but I mean, but you as an artist, as an emerging novelist, so to speak, and as a actor, I mean, to have carried the torch so long and done the same thing over and over and over. And we have, you know, seen with this serial killer portrayal that, you know, there is part of you that does actually want to break out of this.
No, I would say that the only thing that I, to answer your question seriously, that might grow is maybe just the venues that I, you know, this is a different area for me to go into in terms of my persona, to put it in this book in this kind of form. And, you know, so maybe there's something else down the line, you know, that I'll do. Maybe there's a, you know, a goofy Broadway play. Maybe there's, you know, who knows? Maybe there's another project that I can insert my persona into. But I have no plans of changing it. It's what I do, and it's worked for me for 25 years.
But a lot of people don't realize that actually you've won 4 Emmys.
Yeah, but
and
you know,
it seems to me that someone who has, you know, won, has had actually accolades, you know, can in fact evolve as an artist and actually do something a little bit daring, like going even beyond
look at
what Robin Williams did.
I know, but I was saying
okay, you're not, you don't have the talent necessarily of Robin Williams. It doesn't necessarily mean you don't.
The hell are you talking about?
what I mean to say is, and I'm not trying to suggest that you're some sort of small
time
kind
of
comedian.
I know what you're saying, and I'm not trying to be, you know,
besides, Robin Williams
humble
is,
here.
Robin
and,
Williams is far more intense than you. You actually have the measured kind of, you know.
I'm not saying I have kind of the Equus intensity. I think I could do that show.
Yeah.
I'm really happy doing this guy, and, you know, it's sort of not that it's ever reached a level of, you know, huge stardom or anything, but it is kind of like, you know, you're sort of saying, in essence, you know, to Laurel and Hardy, why aren't you guys, you know, trying to do something else? Why aren't you guys trying to grow and do something different? You know, why are you keep making the same guys in the same movies over and over again? And the reason they're doing that is because that's what they did, and they were great at it, and they enjoyed that, their personas and their characters, and look what happened to Charlie Chaplin.
But the thing about Laurel and Hardy is that, like, okay, you've made There's Something About Mary. You've been in Groundhog Day. You're not credited as Chris Elliott. Laurel and Hardy, you watch a Laurel and Hardy movie, they're credited as Laurel and Hardy. You watch the Marx Brothers, they're credited as the Marx Brothers. If you were playing Chris Elliott, the sort of character in these movies, as opposed to a specific role, I'm suggesting that, well, maybe.
No, that's
actually
interesting.
There are additional sides to Chris Elliott that I think I would love to see.
I see what you mean, but yeah. I think, well, that's nice. That's really sweet that you would love to see. But I have maintained that I think almost everything I do, I'm sort of doing that same character, and whether or not it is billed as, you know, Chris Elliott, you know, in Something About Mary instead of Woogie, it was Chris Elliott. It to me, that isn't really the issue. I'm acting sort of the way I would, you know, whether I was doing, you know, Chris Elliott or not, and that persona is in everything that I do. You're right, though. I have, you know, and somebody else was asking me this, you know, when did I make that step from pretending to be an actor to actually, you know, acting? And, you know, deep down, I don't think I have, but obviously to people like yourself, it looks like I have occasionally. And all I can say is I'm much more comfortable with the Chris Elliott who's in The Thwacker than even the Chris Elliott who was in Something About Mary. You know, I'm much more comfortable with this guy.
Well, also, but the thing is the... Okay, well.
No, does that answer it? I mean,
It does, but I don't know. It just seems to me that there is just, I mean, the serial killer. I look at that and I say, look, you know, I mean, and also it just seems to me that you have enough.
All right, let me ask you this. Did you see that episode?
I have not. I don't watch
TV.
Okay,
so, if you had seen it, you could tell me whether or not it's worth pursuing.
Okay, I can tell you this, Chris. Okay, I grew up, you know, as usual, like all the other, you know, people growing up in the 80s. I saw Letterman, I saw Get a Life,
right?
And I enjoyed that, but at the same time, I also recognized that there was something additionally witty there. That there was, I think, perhaps more than you were perhaps giving yourself credit for. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I asked the question to you. It's sort of like, you know, you're not just this persona.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, you know, like, you can be, you don't necessarily have to be sort of the kind of the dependable wiseacre or anything, but you could also maybe, what about being a quiet Chris Elliott? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm talking mm-hmm. extemporaneously, but on 90 minutes of sleep.
Right. And I'm, you know, I'm sleeping while you're talking. But I hear what you're saying, and probably, you know, maybe in my subconscious I've had this debate with myself, but the truth of the matter is, you know, and this sounds corny, but Dave Letterman once said to me, you know, when I was really young and working for him, and in one of the rare moments where he was being sincere to me, he said that, you know, you don't ever change what you do, and an audience will follow, and he was right, you know. And my, you know, not changing, or my always trying, even if people don't really remember what I did on Letterman, my fans, I think, when they read this book, they hear my voice in it, they see that guy in it, and I think they appreciate that I'm still doing that, you know. And and I am, you know, I guess, you know, my biggest fear is, can I be doing this when I'm 60? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer to that is no in my head. But at the same time, if you had asked me at 20 if I could be doing this at 45, I would have said no too. So, you know, as long as it's working for me and I'm enjoying doing it, I'll keep doing it.
Okay. Well, Chris Elliott, thank you very much. Pleasure talking with you.